Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, having interesting conversations with a wide variety of guests, most of them brave truth tellers talking about things that you're not going to hear too much about in the corporate-controlled mainstream. Today we're going to return to deconstructing the war on terror, one of my favorite topics. We've all been whipped into a hysteria of Islamophobia, or at least a lot of folks have, in the post-9/11 era. And the world is erupting in all sorts of problems and trouble spots. So many of those trouble spots do have some kind of component where there's an Islam angle somehow, somewhere. And today I am privileged to be speaking with one of the great peacemakers of our time who is actually focused on those precise kinds of trouble spots, done an immense amount of good. He is one of the Christian world's leading ambassadors to the Muslim world, maybe the leading one in certain respects. It's the former Congressman Mark Siljander. Mark Siljander is with Bridges to Common Ground, a group that is trying to defuse this so-called clash of civilizations between the Christian and Islamic worlds. And it's a noble project, and Mark is doing amazing work, so let's hear about it. Welcome, Mark Siljander. How are you, Mark?
Kevin, doing great. Isn't this your birthday today?
No, I don't know. Skype gets mixed up about these things. I don't know if it told you it was, but it's not.
All right.
But yeah, it's great to hear you again. You know, we've talked a few times over the years, and your story is really, I think, one of the great underreported stories of our time, how you went from a kind of conservative Christian background, believing the usual myths about Muslims, to waking up and doing amazing diplomatic work. Then being strung up on a bogus, totally bogus charges, a kind of a Stalinist show trial thing in the post-9/11 era by the usual neocon suspects, diagnosed with terminal cancer in prison, and you're out, and here you are. It's stunning. Somebody needs to do a Hollywood film about your life if we can get Hollywood into some better hands.
Well, actually, Kevin, I'm writing a second book with the title At War with Peace, and it will depict the indictments and prison and cancer and even the subsequent overcoming of those odds by the power of God, of course. And we're still very much engulfed in peacemaking work using this remarkable model that I believed was, as some Muslims would say, ilham Allah, like an inspiration from God. And this model seems to work, Kevin, and it works consistently. And we were recently in Central Africa confronting a Muslim-Christian conflict there to see if it'll work again.
Really? Tell us a little bit about that, if you can.
Well, in January, we visited Bangui, the capital of Central African Republic. Most of my friends have never heard of it. It's a small country indicative in its name in Central Africa. And there's been an ongoing rift between the Muslim minority and the Christian majority in, we call it CAR for short, Central African Republic, in CAR. And it was really bloody, unfortunately, displacing hundreds of thousands, both Muslims and Christians. The Christians were in power. Then the Muslims staged a coup and took over and then ransacked the city. And then the Christians took power and did the same. I mean, it's a back and forth, typical human instinct of revenge. And it just doesn't work. It just continues the cycle. So anyway, we visited there in January. And we met with both sides, the main militias. And we prayed together. We used what we typically do in our peacemaking. We don't tell them what to do or condemn or even judge. We simply do what I believe the Quran and the Bible stated, and Jesus did without equivocation, is to love your neighbor, your enemy, your best friend, whomever. So that would include the Muslims and Christians in conflict in Central Africa.
So you prayed together with leaders from both sides. And what ensued?
Well, this is, again, the miracle. You know, every verse in the Quran is called an ayah, And in Arabic, ayah, as you know, means miracle. And this was definitely an ayah Allah, a miracle of God. What happened was, after speaking and praying without judging with the Christian militia in this case, 4 hours later, we hear on the news that French hostages were released that were taken by one of the Christian militias in exchange for one of their commanders who was arrested by the United Nations troops for war crimes. And I thought, well, that's nice of them to do that, but we, meaning Bridges to Common Ground, crisis response team, as we call ourselves, our crisis response team did not ask for anything. That's part of our no agenda policy. Because one of the aspects that Jesus taught about love was not to have an agenda. I mean, you can hope for peace. You can hope for hostages to be released. But one shouldn't espouse and push your own agenda. Just sort of go, show up, pray, trust God that through the power of his spirit, things can change, hearts will turn, minds will be transformed, and peace will ensue. And guess what? Within 4 hours, they released the hostages. But we took no great enthusiasm by that, other than in terms of our own work. We're glad that they were released. This is wonderful news. But we were tapped on the shoulder in our hotel during a lunch with one of the top Muslim negotiators for the Muslim factions. And this was the head of the Christian militia that we had met with the day before. And he said, I have some great news for you. Please come upstairs. We want to talk to you about it. And we sat down, and they said, you know, your message about loving our enemies was like God came down from heaven. This is quoting them. And you can go to our website, by the way, if you're interested, and watch a one-minute video of the Christian militia in their own words. It's in French, but we have English subtitles. And so like, you can go to bridgesnow.com and click on videos and watch it. But anyway, he said essentially that we took this message, which is like God coming down from heaven and visiting us, to our main consul and decided that we have no choice but to regain the peace talks, which they were boycotting, and release the two French hostages, which they did without any condition.
Fantastic.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is why I say this approach, love, respect, not agreement. There's nothing in love that mandates, Kevin, that we necessarily agree with each other. My wife and I have been married 31 and a half years, and we have political, theological, relational differences. They're how to rear our kids, what house we should buy, the color of our, you know, Davenport, whatever. We have differences, but we still love each other. We're still married. So the question is, within our differences, if we're Muslim, Christian, Jew, can the Abrahamic three live together, understanding we have, of course, differences and different approaches and different paradigms, but can we find enough common ground between among each other, the three of us, that we can finally look at each other not as infidel, but we can look at each other almost as a brother and sister in, of the one God, of the one Messiah, of the end days, and in loving the in embracing the prophets. I mean, is it really that difficult? And we applied this in Central African Republic in January with astounding results. But Kevin, we were invited back in May, just recently, to a two-week venture, which is a long time in Bangui, I'll tell you, Central Africa. For a two-week working before an eight-day peace conference and working several days afterwards.
Okay, and what happened there?
Well, it was literally what they call fisticuffs. The 10 factions, that's about 4 Muslim, 4 or 5 Christian factions in the transitional government. So there are 10 total factions all in this room, 600 and some 50 participants, 500 chairs, so many had to stand. They argued ferociously, had literal fights, fist fights in the back of the room. I was sitting with one of our top American diplomats who said, I won't mention the vernacular, but he said, this is such and such and it won't work. So we felt we really needed to engage not in manipulation, which is the instinct of diplomats and politicians, military types and economists, but rather, why don't we engage in interconnectivity, interpersonal prayer and connections with both Muslims and Christians, trusting God, not in us, not in models, but trusting that if there is a God, and if his power is expressed in what we call the Holy Spirit, which is in the Quran, the Bible, the New Testament, and the Old Testament, the power of God, then why not trust in it and see if it works? It has worked, at least for in our view, it has worked almost 20 times in the past in global conflicts to releasing hostages just a few months before. So anyway, so we did the same thing. We met with the different sides, prayed, not demanding, not dictating. And then when they asked questions, Kevin, because, you know, I'm a former congressman, so of course, and served in the UN. But so, of course, they're going to ask me questions like that. If you're an engineer, they're going to ask you engineering questions. So they do ask political questions. And when they ask, we give them our, you know, candid response. But it's not seated with I'm right and you're wrong, with pride or with arrogance, because part of love is not being prideful, arrogant, not keeping a record of wrongs of what you're, well, whomever you're in conflict with, you did this and you did that. Like with my wife, I remember I tell her, you know, 6 months ago you said such and such. See, that's not what real love is. Real love is dropping the past and what we've done wrong against each other and looking toward the future, especially with Christian-Muslim relations. If we consider colonialization and slavery, which impacted some portion of the Muslim world, and crusades, you know, for 200 years, five generations of plundering and killing, this is hard to forget. And 9/11 in the hearts of Americans, and various other acts of terror by radical Muslims is also hard to forget. So each side needs to start forgetting. And in Central Africa, we met with the Muslims and Christians in May, as I'm telling you, and they would always bring up a whole litany of wrongs. So when we share this, it seems so simple, Kevin. It seems so simple, but it's so profound. When they hear that Jesus, whom they both believe is the prophet and Messiah and Word of God, both Christians and Muslims, that he taught we need to forget about the past in order to heal our brokenness. We need to forgive the past and move on to the future, or there will be no future. The future will repeat, the past will repeat itself, and the future will be bloody and in turmoil.
Well,
so,
well, you know, Mark, I'll meet you halfway on that. I think that that kind of forgiveness with a kind of forgetting is probably, you know, really where we have to get to. But I would question, you know, whether it's even possible without some modicum of truth and justice. You mentioned 9/11, for example, and I'm sure you know that 80% of the world's Muslims are convinced that it was an inside job, a coup d'etat, a kind of new Pearl Harbor by the neoconservatives designed to launch a 100 years war on Islam. And I've been studying it in great detail for the past more than 10 years, and I personally am convinced of that as well. So my opinion on this topic represents the virtual unanimity of the world's Muslims, and the handful who don't agree with me on this are mostly supporters of Al-Qaeda or worse. So we do that issue of forgive and forget is fine, but we do have this profound difference of opinion about what the truth is about that particular issue. And then there may be other issues as well. And I would argue that we can't completely throw that all away, that we need to have at least a degree of commitment to truth and justice in order to achieve that kind of forgiveness and forgetting.
Okay, I agree with you, Kevin, at least about not forgetting. It's more forgiving in order to heal oneself and then move on to hopefully what God can help build for the future. So we shouldn't forget, and there should be a sense of justice. But there is a scripture verse that says, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom or liberty. So if we really want to experience freedom, liberty, or the sense of justice, if we can live in the shadow of the power of the Almighty, which may sound like a preaching, ultimately, if nowhere else, we as individuals involved in a much bigger conflict or crisis can at least feel freedom and vindicated within ourselves. I met a guy, if I may, Kevin, who was head of the parliament of Rwanda. He lost almost his entire family. He was a Hutu, as you can guess, his entire family in the genocide in the 90s. And I sat with him on the couch as he was reading off a litany of all the people who died in his family. I mean, I was in tears. And Kevin, can you imagine the question was the following: how can you live with all this horrific memory and hate and bitterness and revenge? And he said, I couldn't live and I was ready for suicide. And I even met the perpetrators of the murder of my family who were ultimately arrested and were in prison. And the only way I survived is to forgive them. So the forgiveness isn't forgetting, and they were in prison and they were going to be charged. But forgiving is a thing that I think one needs to do for themselves so they can get, one can get on with their life and let justice prevail. And lastly, my friends will say, yeah, but justice doesn't prevail. Look what happened to you. You got thrown into prison. You had this mysterious rare cancer. It's usually in infants. And all these things happened to you. I said, yes, they did. And I'm not angry, nor am I mad. Would I like justice to be served? Yes. Will it be served? Not in this life. But ultimately, I believe in Judgment Day. And everything we do or don't do will be presented before us. And I think it's better to let God be the judge of our enemy and serve appropriate justice if it's not served here on earth.
Beautifully put. Well, I'm very much on board with you there. And I have incredible respect for this amazing journey of courage that you've been through. It seems, though, that we're almost facing a situation where Christians and Muslims, who I would agree with you, are so close on so many things, so much so that I think that there's a lot more difference in many ways between, say, pick two average Christians just randomly from all of the world's Christians, pick two average Muslims randomly from all of the world's Muslims, and then pick a Christian and a Muslim, and I don't know which one you'd find the most differences between. So I don't know if even this divide between Christian and Muslim is all that meaningful. You know, we're both the universal versions of Abrahamic monotheism, and there are some different details in the way different individuals and groups interpret Abrahamic monotheism, but not to the point that you can sort of lump people as Christian versus Muslim. That's so profoundly misleading. But we are in a conflict now, I think, between the Abrahamic monotheistic tradition, which is still alive, and I would argue maybe a little more alive in the hearts of the world's Muslims than in the hearts of the formerly Christian countries, versus a worldview that is profoundly secular, and I would say profoundly pessimistic, a worldview that says that humans are just another species of animal, that basically carnivorous chimpanzees, that's what evolved their big brains. They committed genocide many times, eliminated the Neanderthals and every other type of other human, and there were lots of other species of human on the earth at the same time that our ancestors were. So committed genocide endlessly, then, you know, now has invented all of these lies about everything from spirituality to human rights to nationalism. All culture is just a bunch of lies. Ultimately, it's a Darwinian struggle, and we're just pieces of matter trying to, you know, fight and ingest and incorporate other pieces of matter. This very, very pessimistic worldview, which is ultimately what non-religious worldviews in the current situation boil down to, I think has produced people who are either completely pessimistic and cynical, who aren't willing to do much besides just try to, you know, pave their own career path and get some goodies and comfort, until the inevitable death, which is going to be a huge disappointment, of course, because then they lost any pleasures that they would have had, any relationships, anything they had is gone forever. That world, or worse, we get these neocons who are basically ultra-Machiavellian, even Satanists, some would say, who are dedicated to evil as the principle that actually works in the world. They go back to Plato and say that, you know, when Plato had that dialogue, the Socratic dialogue about the guy who says that the best way to live is to be good on the outside but evil on the inside, this is the one and only commandment of Strauss and his neoconservative followers. So the people who've reacted to the secular worldview in these ways, I think, are living appalling lives for the most part. And now they've been manipulated into going to war, basically, against Abrahamic monotheism. And both Islam with the 9/11 false flag and Christianity. I mean, the whole point of 9/11 is to have the two remaining monotheisms tear each other apart. So I think we're in a really tough situation here. And clearly, we need to have peace between all monotheists and have monotheists get back to their real heritage of peacemaking and love of God and giving up everything for God. But we're also in a much more kind of terrifying, you know, apocalyptic situation in this struggle against this emerging non-religious worldview. This is my take anyway. What's yours?
Well, I think other than the 9/11 issue, I think we're quite close in our worldview. I mean, we applied just what you said, that to Christians, we said, now, what differences do you have with Muslims? And they would list, you know, three or four major differences. And we'd go through how they weren't really differences. There is my book title, suggests deadly misunderstandings. We do the same with the Muslim side in Central Africa. And then the consequence, which I never got to in May, and I'm glad you brought it up, was this process of discussing not politics, but how our faiths are so similar and what we think are differences. You know, these traditional issues, which we'll get to in a minute, we think are differences, Son of God, Trinity, and so forth, that divide us and are used to manipulate both sides, are really false flags in themselves, in my opinion. And hence, there's no need to be driven to hate and bitterness and views of other being the infidel for things that aren't even correct, out of ignorance. So the upshot of the May visit in Central Africa, Kevin, was that all 10 factions signed a peace treaty. They all began disarming, and it was an astounding success. But as in any situation, any person, when they come to faith, so to speak, they need to be discipled. They need to be trained and educated. Paul said, the apostle, we need to get off the milk and get onto the meat, meaning spiritually. And so is a nation growing and seeking peace in the midst of conflict and hate. It's not just going to transform overnight. It's a transforming of the mind and the heart. It happens immediately, but it's a long process to become embedded, if you will.
So how about these really, front page kinds of extreme conflict situations that we're seeing today, right in the heartland of Middle Eastern monotheism? You know, we're talking about in the land of Palestine, the Holy Land. Close to the Holy Land right now, we have some very extreme conflicts. We have the Zionist versus Palestinian thing spinning out of control. And I would argue that what we're seeing here is basically a Zionist genocide of Palestine, and Palestinians desperately fighting for their survival against this genocide. But, you know, other people would probably describe it somewhat differently. In any case, that's a very, very extreme and religiously driven conflict. And then likewise over in Syria, we have ISIL, ISIL, this group of so-called Muslims who are, you know, the exact opposite of everything that you and I would say makes one a real Abrahamic monotheist. These people are dedicated to killing those who think differently from themselves. And I would argue that ISIL, like Zionism, is committing genocide as well. So, I mean, this is really the obvious center, sort of the ground zero of the conflict between religions, which I think is also being driven by the conflict between this kind of neocon and other post-religious worldviews versus religion. It's all happening right there, and where Jesus walked the earth. Somebody going to, you know, take the Bridges to Common Ground team and parachute them over Syria or Palestine? I mean, it seems like we almost need to.
Well, Kevin, I just want to clarify that my expression of what's happening in the Middle East would be different than yours, just for the record.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
I wouldn't use quite such terminology, but it's all the same spirit, if you will. I don't mean the spirit of God. I mean it's the same spirit of evil. It's the same spirit. See, they know nothing else. All we know is war, economic manipulation, diplomatic negotiation around political issues. So I'll repeat, there's military, economic, political, and diplomatic. Those are the four tracks, if you will, that the world knows and none other. But they've never considered a spiritual track to bring conflicted parties together spiritually. My daughter, let's bring it home. We have a daughter. We have three daughters and a son. And I was becoming alienated because of my certain beliefs, moral beliefs, with one of my daughter. And my wife said, "You're a big hypocrite. You travel all over the world talking to people who perpetuate genocides, murder, that are despot leaders who steal money from their people. And you hug them and pray with them and don't criticize them, but yet you come home and can't handle your own daughter." So my feeling, Kevin, this is going to sound a little bizarre, if I could not at least relationally reconnect with my daughter, I was going to quit what I'm doing. I'm not doing this for the money, as you can guess. I got thrown into prison as a consequence of it, for nothing. For making peace, but that's another subject.
So just for the listeners' benefit, we've been over this a little bit in detail, but there was this ridiculous trumped-up prosecution where, as far as I could tell, it looked like they had actually set you up to say, "Oh, here's a foundation grant for writing a book," and then they turn around and say, "Oh, well, we did just define this organization that we set up to give you the money to write the book as a terrorist organization. Let's, you know..." You don't have to say anything about that, but it's just an outrageous story.
Yeah, well, it's going to come out in my second book and hopefully in a Hollywood movie that may well follow. So with my own daughter, I've said, okay, what is the criteria that we use to love? Love is patient. Love is kind. I mean, who does that with Palestinian Israelis? Who does that with ISIL? No one. Who comes into situations by keeping a record of wrongs, being boastful and proud? All of us do. We all come in boastful. We all come in proud. We have the answers. And we all guilty of, including yours truly. But I tried, okay, I need to change my own tact of my own family. Our daughter and I, we still have differences of worldview. But we are really reconnected relationally and love each other desperately. So my wife said, "Carry on with your work, because if it can work with your own daughter, it will certainly work anywhere else, and vice versa."
Wow, that's a great lesson. You know, I actually hear similar things from my wife, who's helped guide me in this matter as well. You know, she's very aware in a kind of intuitive way that maybe I'm not, that, you know, peace starts in your own soul and in your own relationships. And, you know, if you want to heal the world, heal yourself first.
Exactly. Exactly. That's, you know, healer, heal yourself. So peacemaker, make peace at home. If you can't, quit. Do something different. Go back into politics, which was, you know, talk about intransigence and paralysis. You know, I spent 15 years in the local governments, state Congress, federal Congress, United Nations. And yes, they were cushy jobs, and it was frustrating. And I went in with high hopes, Kevin, changing the world, impacting peace, traveled around the world, and really made very little to no impact. As a someone, did almost nothing. As a nobody, we're doing, I believe, works that were beyond our even wildest fantasies when I was serving in the Congress.
Interesting. You know, and so many people think that that's really where power is in the world of traditional politics, which we've learned from such gloomy political theorists as Carl Schmitt and then his satanic disciple Leo Strauss, that politics is all based on enmity, on uniting a group against some scapegoat other group. You know, and frankly, as much as I have to question the overall worldview of people like Carl Schmitt, I mean, I have to admit there's something to that, because that is what a lot of politicians basically do. They unite people against somebody else. I mean, Schmitt said that politics was the science of organized hatred, and unfortunately it almost seems that way. So maybe it really was a good thing that your calling was to get out of that and to get into the science of peacemaking, which is organized love.
Now, it's very interesting you bring that up, Kevin. When I was in Congress, Newt Gingrich, Trent Lott, who was ran for Vice President of the United States at one time, was passed away. Trent Lott, and also Jack Kemp, who's passed away. We worked to take over the House of Representatives, who was controlled by the Democrats. We wanted the Republicans to take over because we were Republicans. So what we did, and I was a big, big neoconservative Christian. What we did was, let's find ways to divide people and put wedges in between people. So we'll put enough wedges in enough groups that the side that we're on, that we support, like pro-life or anti-taxes or whatever, we could take that group, organize them in coalitions, and have enough to win elections. Well, we just need 50 plus one vote, 50% and one vote. And, Kevin, it worked. This process will work. The problem is, it's not redemptive. So, what was the legacy when the Republicans, all my friends, took over the House? I was gone at the time, but I helped them write the plan. And they took over, and I met with one of the leaders. If I mention his name, you'd know him immediately, and I'd rather not, because he's still a close friend. I asked, what is your legacy? You had Christians in the House, Christians in the Senate, a Christian president. So now you had Christians running everything. What's the legacy? And he was, you know, after a few minutes of hemming, I said, well, we really didn't leave much of a legacy. I said, exactly. So what good does it do for Christians or anyone to listen to what you speak about still out of Congress now? He speaks about getting Christians in Congress or in politics. I said, really, we're half-breeds. Brother, I said, we're half-breeds. Yes, we love God, and we're going to go to heaven as a consequence. We've been redeemed by God. Praise the Lord. However, we turn around and hate our neighbor. Because who is the Republican neighbor in Congress?
Republican neighbor in what sense?
Well,
the Democrats, I guess you mean. Yeah. The guys across the aisle, yeah.
Because Jesus said your neighbor to the Jews was not another Jew. Then remember, the neighbor that we're admonished to love from Leviticus was always considered another Jew. It's like Republican, just love Republicans, but you can go ahead and hate Democrats, or Christians, you can love Christians but hate Muslims kind of mentality. But Jesus said, no, it's a Samaritan. And the Samaritan was despised by the Jews as a half-breed. And I told this leader, former leader that of the Congress, that we're half-breeds ourselves because we love God on one hand and adhere to half of what the greatest commandment is. But the other half of the commandment to love our neighbor, which could be our enemy or the person or group we disdain, which in our case were Democrats, we hated them. We manipulated them. We try to destroy them, everything opposite of what Jesus taught us how to love our enemy and bless those who persecute us and do good to them that hate you. We did evil to them. We did everything the opposite of what Jesus taught, and you wondered why we failed? Because, yes, we were, I'll repeat, maybe we were right with God halfway, but the other half, his Messiah said to us to love our neighbor and even told us, how? And we didn't do 100% of what he said, every point of how to love the Democrats. We did literally the opposite. So, of course, we failed. and it will continue to fail until we are more fully completed. You know, salam or shalom was what we use for peace, but also means to be completed, to finish something. And the way we're completed, I believe, as followers of the one true God, is to start loving our enemies. And I don't mean agreeing, again, I want to emphasize, I don't mean agree philosophically or even theologically with them or politically. It's how do we respond to our neighbor, which could be our best friend or our worst enemy.
Interesting. And you know, that leads to a question. You know, when you mention the Congress falling into the hands of Christians and there's a Christian president and everything, sometimes I scratch my head and wonder, how could Christian leaders be so excited about possessing so many nuclear weapons and, you know, even thinking of using them? You know, we've heard that there's some kind of dominionist cult in the armed services, and I won't go back to 9/11 and how Gordon Duff and my friends at VT think that this particular group of extremists who actually work with the Church of Satan, that's a long story, let's not go there, but anyway, that there are some very, very militaristic, perhaps even demonic, nominal Christians, some of them centered in important positions in the Air Force, that's been a terrible problem for our military in the last 15, 20 years. But in any case, the question would be, how can anybody who's a Christian be okay with nuclear weapons? You know, over in Iran, the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, has carried forward the edict of his predecessor, the Imam Khomeini, that nuclear weapons, and indeed weapons of mass destruction in general, are haram, or religiously forbidden. And indeed, Iran did not respond in kind when Iraq used U.S.-supplied chemical weapons against Iran during the war in the 1980s. So the Iranians have what seems to me to be kind of an obvious, religiously honest, normal policy, which is no nuclear weapons. It's forbidden completely, which of course leads us to ask what the whole crisis and negotiations were all about. Whereas Christian countries happily stockpile huge numbers of nuclear weapons, and the so-called Christian West is pushing towards Russia's borders and working towards a possible nuclear World War III that would obviously be a war of aggression against Russia, whereas President Putin appears to be something of a Christian and representing Christian values in his country. He's being demonized here. The question would be, what's going on? How can Christians engage in such extremely unchristian behavior? I guess it's like the ISIL people doing non-Muslim behavior, but it's just really shocking at how utterly unlike the teachings of Jesus a lot of this is.
You've asked numbers of huge questions, Kevin. Is you're such a thinker and so deep in your analysis. But let me try to summarize just a response to your very, very penetrating and provocative question. It comes down to how we view religion. I sat with the top sheikh in Sudan for dinner some years ago. And I asked him, I said, Sheikh, you say the true religion with Allah is Islam. Is that correct? He goes, yes, that's what the Quran says. I said, okay. What does religion mean to you? He said, well, religion in Arabic is deen, pronounced deen, almost like the man's name in English, deen. Anyway, I said, is that, what does that mean? Is that an institution? He said, no, it's not a club, a religious club. It's a state of your life, of your faith. He said, so if your state of your faith is submitted, Islam, to God, then you're a Muslim, or then you're in the true deen, you're in the true religion. I said, well, I come from a Christian background, and I definitely want to submit my life to God and struggle every day to do it. Fail, yes, but that's my struggle, is to do that. He said, well, then you'd be a spiritual Muslim and living with the deen or religion of submission to God. I said, now, how many Muslims even think that way or know that? He said, not too many, but they could if they were taught properly. I said, well, when are you going to start? We both have to start teaching. You need to teach Muslims, and my job could be to teach Christians, that really, if we focus on religion, it will perpetuate crusades and inquisitions because they have something to protect. They create institutions and leaders that they have to then create armies and security forces to protect. But if we're organically connected, heart to heart, mind to mind, spirit to spirit, then this organic movement, which Jesus in the first 300 years, Kevin, as you know, the first 300 years, they were not called Christians. They didn't call themselves Christians. They were called that at Antioch and other places by the pagans. They called themselves people of the way. They were following what they thought was a Jewish sect that turned into a global sect, if you will, of non-Jews as well, following the teachings of Jesus. And this movement, without lifting a sword, think of this, without lifting a sword, undermined the world's most powerful military empire, Rome, and ultimately Rome adopted the Jesus movement. And unfortunately, in my opinion, Emperor Constantine, who called it the favored religion of the empire, took an organic movement, defined it as an institutional religion, and that's what caused, in my opinion, the problems for Christianity anyway in the future. So it's religion versus relationship, religion versus institutional religion versus a way of life and living, surrender to God and loving your neighbor.
Wow, that's beautifully put. And it's true that Muslims need to be educated about this, but you know, maybe not as much as some people would think, because it is fairly understood in Islam that Islam just means submission to God, and that there's a Islam with a small I, which means, you know, anybody who submits to God. And then there's this Islam with a big I, which is the institutionalized religion. And maybe we need a more of an emphasis on the real, you know, first meaning of Islam with the small I. And Christians, of course, need education just as much, if not more. And you're one of the leading people doing that. Do you have any luck getting to address Christians in the U.S.? We have, you know, anti-Muslim sort of warmonger types, people like, what's that guy's name? Walid al-Shahri, I think. No, whatever. I think it is Walid al-Shahri, this guy who speaks to large crowds. He gets lots of money, saying that he's a former Palestinian terrorist and all the Muslims are terrorists and they all want to kill you. I think that's the name of his book, is We Want to Kill You. So these guys are getting a lot of money and getting big crowds as they go around talking to Christians. And then you're coming from a much, I would say, more accurate and perspective, accurately Christian, as well as accurate in terms of its approach to religious differences. Are you having any success in getting speaking engagements and reaching out to the American Christian community, which has been so propagandized?
The short answer is yes, we are having a modest success. We have, with Bridges to Common Ground, project called Ambassadors in Action. We're talking about Central Africa, the Middle East. This is in the United States right at home. We have a group, for example, in Charlotte, North Carolina, of 19 pastors, at least 17 of whom are evangelical charismatic pastors who would more typically be anti-Muslim and have a more of a fear-based paradigm. They've read my book, A Deadly Misunderstanding. We've had a chance to connect, at least if not in brief, one-on-one. And a group of them agreed to meet the Muslim leadership in Charlotte. That's big. I don't know if you realize it, but for the mainline liberal churches, that's not that big of a deal. But for Assemblies of God or Vineyard or Evangelical Church or Baptist churches to do pastors to venture out, which they could be highly condemned for by their own communities, and sit and break bread and talk about, well, how do we each think, what is this Trinity anyway? What does Son of God really mean? When we say Jesus is divine, what do we mean by that? And actually talk on serious issues and find common ground together. They were so shocked that they've met four times, and we coordinated Islamophobia conference at a public forum in Charlotte, and we're establishing a similar venue in South Carolina, in Raleigh, and we have 18 cities prepared once we know how to do it ourselves, Kevin, and it seems to go smoothly, then we hope to write a replicable model that would that others around the United States could learn, evangelicals can learn how to connect with and talk with Muslims in a respectful, a faith, hope-filled way rather than fear and trepidation and disdain.
Fantastic. That sounds great. And, you know, we've had a big victory here in the last 24 hours over Islamophobia and the politics of splitting Muslims from Christians and fear-mongering and clash of civilizations hype and all of that with the defeat of Stephen Harper up in Canada. I've been hanging out with Canadians, including I did a speaking tour last summer through Canada, Western Canada. I met these great people like Saima, shout out to Saima, and others who have been working overtime on these kinds of issues, trying to defuse the hate and divisiveness. And it looks like it worked. Most of the analyses I'm seeing so far suggest that Harper lost a lot of support due to his over-the-top, shrill, you know, very, very intensive Muslim bashing and, you know, hyping up this alleged threat that more and more people are recognizing is vastly smaller than they're telling us. And so that there's a sign that, you know, maybe things are going in the right direction, at least in northern North America. And there are even those who are seeing this as a portent of better times in the U.S. of A. as well. So maybe things are moving in the right direction, and the folks out there are going to become more and more receptive to your message.
Well, that's good news about Canada, and it's not easy, Kevin. I must say this is an uphill battle here, at least in the United States. I can't speak for Canada, but here, even in Charlotte, which is, of course, you know, this area is the Bible Belt. And I think people, when they hear the message, and here's what the message is, very simple. Did Jesus teach us to fear? They say no. What did he say about fear? He said love casts out all fear. I said, oh. So Jesus said love casts out all fear. So we have a fear of Islam and Sharia law and ISIS and Muslims overpopulating America and taking over our schools and their secret cells. We have this fear, correct? Yes. I said, all right. So how should you, as a pastor who follows the teachings of Jesus, so how do we deal with Muslims then? Who are our neighbors, by the way, here in Charlotte? And they'll say, well, I guess we have to deal with them in love. I said, exactly. And then we go through, Kevin, the simple do's and don'ts of love. There are seven do's, like do be kind, do be patient, always trust, always hope, always support, always protect. Are we protecting Muslims? Are we helping them? And when here in Charlotte, there was a Muslim family whose house was shot 18 times, and the mother of several children in the house was hit in the leg. I actually met with this family. My heart went out to this family. They didn't do anything except they were resting in their house and bullets flying through their house and hit the mother. Thankfully, no one was seriously injured. But this shows you the hate and bitterness. And many Christians did rally around this family. And when we went to the Islamophobic conference here in Charlotte, this family stood up and wanted to thank the Christians for coming to their to help them and encourage them and bring them meals and things. So, yes, it's going to be difficult, Kevin. This is not at all easy to break a mentality, a paradigm, a phobia. But if it happened to me, a right-wing neoconservative, pro-war type person, it can certainly happen to the good, well-intended pastors of the United States.
That would be great. And how about the current presidential race in the U.S.? That it does seem that the Republican candidates, that would be your ex-party, are falling all over themselves to bash Islam and particularly Iran. It seems that they're targeting the Iran deal, and they can collect money from people like Las Vegas mafia magnate Sheldon Adelson by being the meanest and nastiest towards Islam and towards Iran. Do you see any hope that the Republican Party, your former home, will at some point get past this?
I would certainly hope so. However, what's disappointing, and that's why in the earlier comments we stated it was an uphill battle, the more the candidates seem to say something extremely negative against immigrants, Muslims, their poll numbers go up, not down. So they're playing to what seems to be popular, which is absolutely unfortunate. So as I say, Kevin, we need to work together as much as we can, as you in the media, me out in the hustings and writings and so forth, to slowly bring America to start thinking differently. Because, frankly, what hope is there in a fear-based and, as you said, secular worldview? Fear, I wrote down what you said, Kevin. You said, if I recall, fear is secular. It's what the world uses, and it uses it to manipulate. And yet Jesus, whom we claim to follow as our Messiah, said just the opposite, literally the opposite. So Christians have no position to promote, to engage in, articulate, or preach a fear-based message. None whatsoever.
Wow, beautifully put. And there are some other groups doing work similar to yours. I actually did cite your work in my introductory essay to the book We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. And then I also cited the work of the Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad group. John Andrew Morrow is a scholar who has been publicizing the Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World, which appear to be authentic documents outlining the way that early Islam was not against other religions in general, Christianity in particular. And we know this from other documents, of course, like the Constitution of Medina, the first Muslim polity. But these Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad, the Christians of the World, charge on all Muslims for all time the responsibility of protecting Christians and treating them well. This is so counter to what's been going on with ISIL and the these so-called Tekfiri groups, who seem to hate everybody who's not themselves. Of course, they persecute Muslims worse than they persecute Christians. But in any case, have you heard of the Covenants Initiative, and would you consider working with it?
I have heard of it, and through you, Kevin, and will review it, and do not have a thoughtful comment to make on it because I really don't know enough about it. But I have looked at it. I have it up in the website, and we'll review it when I have a few minutes to do so. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, because to me this is very important. This Tekfiri extremism in Islam is really, they claim to be going back to the original practices of the first prophet and first followers, but they are not. It's quite the opposite. The original practice was to forge coalitions. It was really a multi-confessional polity in Medina, and thereafter, there was no, you have to interpret things exactly the way we do, or you're dead or out. All that stuff is really, it's a modern problem. And yet the people that are committing these atrocities based on this false interpretation of Islam are imagining themselves going back to the pure early version. So that, to me, this is a very, very important thing. As a Muslim, I'm very disgusted and horrified by these Tekfiri imbeciles. I wonder whether they would respond well to your kind of peacemaking. Sometimes, I'm a little skeptical just because, you know, they seem to be so far gone, but I don't know. Maybe they would have to hear it from a Christian.
Well, I'm not sure if they have to hear it from a Christian, but remember, the Quran and the Bible both talk about the invisible, the power of the invisible. It's Yud Allah in the Aramaic, which means the hand of God or the right hand, which means power. And I believe that the Ruh HaQuddis, which is the Holy Spirit in Arabic, is like the right hand of God when he speaks things into being, like the heavens and the earth. He speaks something and people say there was a big bang. Well, maybe, you know, maybe when God spoke this whole universe and solar system into being, there might have been an explosion. Who knows? I can't say there wasn't, but I'm not against a big bang, because that could have been a consequence of the power of God creating things. And when he spoke into Mary's womb, the Arabic kun fayakun, be in it, and it is, he spoke Jesus into being by the, it says in the Quran, we breathe a ruh, our spirit, in her. So this spirit, this power, is invisible, but it's tangible. When you sit, as I said, with militias who kidnap and kill, and within hours release hostages when you didn't ask them to, and when you send a letter to a foreign minister asking to release Miriam Ebrahim, who was in prison in Sudan because she wouldn't renounce her faith, because her mother, as you might recall, was Christian and her dad was a Muslim, and she chose Christianity and married a Christian. She was imprisoned, had a baby there. Christians in America were having a heyday, raising money, signing petitions, like a petitions of Christians in America are going to influence Omar al-Bashir in the Sudan, who's the president there. It just shows either they're just trying to raise money or naivete. But you know what worked? A simple letter with respect, reflecting the spiritual foundation of, you know, the seven do's and don'ts of love. And within days, she was released.
Mashallah. That's beautiful. I guess, you know, I think appealing to people's sense of mercy as well in these kind of situations is got to be the way to go. You know, that both Islam and Christianity hold mercy and compassion as very, very high ideals. And it seems like you've had amazing success in helping awaken a lot of Muslim political leaders to that divine commandment of mercy.
How about this, Kevin? It's not just Muslim leaders. Do you remember when Pastor Terry Jones in Florida, about 4 years ago, threatening to burn Qurans? There were riots all over the world. The Pope, Obama, Hillary Clinton, General Petraeus begging him not to, and all that did was push him harder to do it. Well, why do you think he all of a sudden, at the last minute, decided not to burn the Qurans? No one knows about this because a lot of this is done in secret. He was also sent a letter that was given to him approximately 1 p.m. on a particular day. I think it was a Thursday. And by 5 p.m., 4 or 5 hours later, he's announcing he's not burning the Qurans, because the same strategy was applied to what I'd call a very misinformed, egocentrical pastor. It worked again.
Wow.
Now you say, you sure it was the letter? I said the letter didn't harm, but what the letter does, the one in Sudan, the one that was delivered to Pastor Jones, these visits in Central Africa or whether it's in Congo, wherever, what it does, it releases the unseen. And if you find that fanciful and foolish, that's the trouble I have with policymakers, including the U.S. government. They say, what is the power that you use behind this? I say, it's not voodoo, and it's not psychic. It's simply the power of God. Well, who are you to release the power of God? I am a nobody. I simply carry a message. I'm like the mailman. Didn't write the message, didn't package the message. I'm just delivering it. And when you deliver the message, and it's good news, because it's called the Injil in the Quran, when you deliver the good news, guess what happens? The Spirit of God is released. The power to transform people's hearts, transform how they think, and hence often the behavior following.
Hear, hear. Well, all I can say to that is, Amin, brother. That's amen in Muslim speak. Thank you so much, Mark Siljander. I appreciate your amazing work. God bless you, and keep it up. I look forward to the next round.
Thank you so much, Kevin. God bless you too. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.